Earners, what's up? Look, I want to give y'all a little peek behind the curtain of producing Earn Your Leisure. It's a lot more than just sitting down and chatting. It involves meticulous planning, recording, editing, and then promoting each episode to ensure it reaches all of you. And if you picked up any of our merch, then you know there's a whole extra layer of logistics from inventory management to shipping. Running a podcast is like running a small business. And speaking of business, I know many of you entrepreneurs are involved in e-commerce. You understand how crucial it is to streamline operations and cut costs wherever possible. That's why I want to talk to you about ShipStation, the multi-carrier shipping solution that integrates seamlessly with all your online sales channels. It's all about optimizing your shipping, connecting with expert partners, and freeing up more of your time to focus on scaling your business. Now let's talk about our experience with ShipStation. This tool has been a game changer for us, especially with automating routine tasks. Being able to manage everything from one dashboard and print shipping labels with just a click, absolute lifesavers. Plus, the discounts we get on shipping costs are incredible. Honestly, it feels like we're saving thousands. And as our show and merch sales have grown, ShipStation's robust automation and reporting features have helped us keep up without missing a beat. For those of you who get overwhelmed by order volumes, ShipStation's easy-to-use dashboard is a dream come true. You can import orders from any sales channel, apply shipping preferences automatically, and handle customer service issues right there. Not to mention the savings with up to 89% off carrier rates like UPS, DHL Express, and USPS. It's no wonder over 130,000 companies stick with ShipStation long term. So, are you ready to turn your shipping challenges into growth opportunities? Head over to ShipStation.com and use promo code EARN for a free 60-day trial. Again, that's ShipStation.com, promo code EARN. Start streamlining your shipping and scaling your business today. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Earners, what's up? Look, today I want to talk to you about something that's been on my mind, a real weight on my shoulders. You know, we all have these moments, big or small, that just stick with us. When we don't talk about these things, then they can start to affect our lives in unexpected ways. That's why having a space to express these feelings is so important. I know firsthand the benefits of therapy. It's been transformative for my friends and family. Therapy can help you learn crucial skills like setting boundaries and developing coping strategies. It's not just about dealing with major events. It's also about enhancing your day-to-day life, allowing you to become the best version of yourself. So if you've been thinking about therapy, BetterHelp can be a great option for you. It's entirely online, which makes it super convenient and adaptable to your busy schedule. You start by filling out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. And you can even switch therapists at any time if you feel the need, without any additional cost. So get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/EarnYourLeisure today to get 10% off your first month. Remember, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/EarnYourLeisure. Don't wait. Don't hesitate. Head over there now.
All right, guys. Welcome back. Earn Your Leisure. This is a episode that could have happened five times already.
Let's start there.
Yeah, but we finally got it done. But before we start, by the time you guys hear this, 3 days, 4 days before the big one, we come into Philadelphia, March 14th, March 15th. We have a live podcast on the 14th. And that's going to be with our brother Wallow267.
Excited about that.
The legend himself.
Yep.
Greg Parker, a.k.a. Big Business.
King of Philly.
Nehemiah Davis.
Amazing.
And just added to the bill. John Henry. Shout out to
brother.
Our guy, John
Henry. What up?
Henry.
What up, John?
Yes. And our guest today.
Somebody familiar to that flyer.
Yes. We're gonna give him a full introduction.
Yeah, let's do it right.
We're going to do it right. So Sunday, we have our workshop. And the workshop is going to be Vending Biz, Kashif Edwards, Alex Good Energy.
Our brother.
Yeah, the king of trucking.
Yep.
And Atiyah Blair and Aisha Sheldon, they're going to do a tag team real estate.
It's going to be crazy.
And they're going to talk about how to build a $1 million real estate portfolio starting with nothing. So it's crazy. The live podcast, open bar, it's catered.
Yeah.
It's a networking event. Yeah. After. It's a whole.
Yeah, EYL rules, man. Drink responsibly, act accordingly.
Yeah. So all the information is on EYLExperience.com. Like I said, you got a couple of days to get tickets. Don't play yourself. Don't miss out on this.
Reward
man.
Yourself.
Can't wait to touch the town. So All right, Philadelphia, we'll see you. So, without further ado, we gotta announce the young legend that we got in the building today. Ani Sanal. Senor.
You got it.
He got it, man. Yeah.
I was under a lot. I get nervous when I don't know people's names.
Only with the names. That's
cause
it.
Because people mess up my name so much that I've become very sensitive to that. But, yeah, so this is actually a while in the making. As I said, we had a schedule for a few different times. And we had to go out of town, and a lot of stuff came up.
I think he was on tour for a few weeks.
We're here. So I'll give the backstory. So did everything from music, started a record label when he was in high school, inspired by Jay-Z, which fits right in the podcast because we mentioned.
You know, we love that.
We mention Jay all the time.
We love that.
He's currently a real estate investor, a real estate in Jersey and Philly. Then he also has a digital marketing agency.
Big time.
Where he's worked with Hillary Clinton.
GRC.
That's pretty big.
This guy's not playing.
That's extremely big. He has one of the hottest tea. Is it okay to call it a tea?
Yeah, chai.
Yeah, chai tea shops in Manhattan, which is blowing up. Anything I'm missing?
We got the Idea Exchange.
Idea Exchange.
Yeah, where people come together with ideas and find out how to make them turn them into businesses.
Yeah, so he's a serial entrepreneur.
What can he do?
The term gets thrown around, and he's only 31 years old. So
he could put out a Hot 16, right?
So the term gets thrown around very lightly, but he's a serial entrepreneur. So we got a lot of things that we need to talk about in this. So first and foremost, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Appreciate you for real. This is exciting, and we talked about this for so long.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, for sure. So all right, so let's jump right into it. So you start your first business in the music business as a record label when you're in high school. But so your parents are from India, right? You're of Indian descent.
Yep.
And they moved to this country like right when you're born, right?
Yeah.
So, okay. So you are an Indian kid growing up in Boston?
Right outside Boston, yeah.
But you fell in love with hip hop music. And then you decided to start a record label because you're inspired by Jay-Z and Rockefeller. Is that correct?
Yeah, a little bit. So the funny thing about entrepreneurship now, it's like the sexiest thing. You know, everybody's trying to get into it. And for me, like my origins with entrepreneurship were not sexy at all. And what it was growing up as an immigrant kid, you know, watching your parents always get laid off or always be at the victim of the job market, never being in control of their own scenario. I'm talking about like 8, 10, 12 years old. I knew that whatever I was going to do, I was always going to be owning that. Or creating a future for myself where I would never have to think about how do I put food on my family's plate.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that there's a few Christmases where your dad came home like job's done.
Yeah, I talk about it a lot because it's important for me to contextualize my story. You know, like now, you know, I'm on tour with my artist or, you know, doing a podcast with people like y'all and it's all fun and games. But, you know, this started from like a very... I don't want to say out of desperation, but it started out of like that hopelessness that you feel when you can't take care of your family. Mm-hmm. And so growing up, you know, as a brown kid, you're already feeling like an outsider because growing up in the 90s, we had no reference point. Mm-hmm. It was Apu on The Simpsons. It was the only thing, you know, and we could laugh about it. But, you know, on the other side of it, I was like, damn, this can't be life.
This is
literally it. And, you know, I think hip hop music and hip hop culture, for the first time, I was able to see a person of color in a position of ownership, you know, and watching Jay, how he ran up the score, you know, in the 90s and the 2000s, like that MTV Diary that he did. I don't know if y'all remember that.
Yeah, I remember that.
And just watching somebody like, oh, they controlling culture and they're controlling the narrative and they own what they do. I was like, yeah, that's it.
So at that point in high school, you're looking at that like, I can do that.
I don't know if I was looking at it like, I can do that. I think I was looking at it like, I have a story to tell.
Okay.
And I wanted to tell that story in a real way. And, you know, I knew from early on I wasn't that square kid. Like my parents, you know, respect to them because they let me cook. But when they saw me coming home with jeans, you know, sagging below my waist and 4 fake chains on, they must have been like,
yeah, we got to get a
picture.
What
is he doing? Like, we got to... Let's see if I got one. But, you know, I was never like, I could never be a doctor or a lawyer or a banker because to me, I just always thought outside the box, you know, and being a creative kid and always just having that spirit, like, how do we figure it out? And I think that comes from not having things. You know, like you're always going to figure out how to get to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in high school, I teamed up, you know, with a friend of mine. And I was like, look, there's a lot of stuff happening on digital at this time. So this is MySpace era.
Okay.
So you, at the three clicks, you could A, amplify your music to everybody in the world, and or you could discover something you've never heard before. And it just changed the way, you know, we like digested and consumed music. So I'm looking at that like, okay, if I have these tools at my disposal, you know, how do I tell my story through music? How do I create a world that I want to live in and create financial, you know, independence out of that?
Mm-hmm.
So give y'all some ideas of how I think. Like even in high school, we used to, during the lunchtime, we used to like hand out little flyers in the morning, like, yo, we having a live show in this staircase, in this hallway at 12:30 p.m. pull up, and we'd have a boombox, and like I'd have a bunch of my friends just come through. We'd like freestyle or, you know, perform songs or battle or whatever it was. And these stairways used to be packed out.
Oh man, you selling know? Out stairways.
Yeah, you know I mean, young age. And then I remember we printed up an album. So like I sold whatever PlayStation games I had. I think I was like working $10 an hour boxing, like packing boxes or something. Put all that money together and printed up like 300 album copies of an album that we put out. And them joints sold out in like 4 days.
Oh wow.
You was rapping?
Yeah, I was. Okay. I was executive producing. I was rapping. I was managing the whole process. I was, you know, using digital to like distribute all the stuff. So we had an album on iTunes when I was like 17 years old because I had figured out how to crack that code super early. And then we're selling physical CDs. And I'm turning, what is it, $2 to print a CD into $7 when you sell it.
So you're on iTunes and the music is moving for $7 an album? That's what you're getting off of it?
No, I'm selling $7 CDs.
Oh, CDs. Okay.
This is like back when, you know, you
hand in hand.
Yeah, still play it in your car. Yeah, like, yeah. I had my pop's purple Corolla, but that joint, you know, I would play my joint. And but I'm just watching people like consume it.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, nah. And that's the first time I ever had like a stack in my pocket, like a knot, and being like, oh, it's a whole different thing. I just made money. Yeah, I made money off of an idea. That's so empowering. And then we're like, yo, let's try doing some merchandise. Sold out 30 t-shirts. Now that knot's getting bigger. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Honey hustles.
You know what I mean? So that was the origin. And I took that to, I will skip a couple steps, but I took that from starting at 16, developing it all through my early 20s. And when I was 22 years old, I got offered to go live and tour in Japan for 6 weeks off of music. And that was a moment of crystallization.
As an artist.
I did a brand deal with Marlboro, the cigarette company out of Japan. Never smoked in my life. Doesn't matter. But they were like, yo, we'll pay you X, Y, and Z for these three tracks. And I was like, yeah, run that bag. Yeah. Called my best friends and my label partners at the time. And we all, 22 years old, black and brown kids living in Japan, in Tokyo, running up the score.
Run it up.
And spiking the football.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That moment, I was like, oh, I could do whatever it is I want in my life because I turned my ideas into.
Even as a 16-year-old kid, to be an artist is one thing, right? But you're thinking CEO, man. Like, I'm going to create a record label. And now, so how does this go from being an artist and record label to now getting a deal like Marvel? Like, are you in front of them pitching this? How does this work?
Yeah, I was always talking to like the decision makers at some level, right? So like the Japan thing happened through somebody that saw us at a showcase. And I remember I had just quit the only day job I've ever worked. I worked for 2 weeks and I had just graduated. I worked a day job for 2 weeks. I was like, nah, that's not me. And somebody came up to me at a showcase and was like, yo, you want to live in Japan and go on tour? And I was like, yeah, all right.
Let me think about this.
But it was just having the wherewithal to like, I have a press kit ready. I have, you know, an EPK. I got, you know, videos, I have content you can consume. I got a story and I got a website and it's all packaged in a way that a decision maker can be like, okay, these guys are moving, something's happening. I could give you analytics of my last, you know, four releases and things like that. I always thought that way because I knew that if I couldn't monetize my craft, I wasn't about to be a broke artist.
Struggling artist wasn't appealing to you.
Yeah, it's still not. there's no glory in that. And so that's just how my mentality was. And obviously, you know, when you coached by Jay, like I joked that Rockefeller was my MBA, because I just studied how to make certain moves, you know, from that position. And And yeah, gotta think about it, a brown kid, you know, with no context in the music game, being able to do that, to me, it was just like, all right.
So what made you, this before Punjabi MC?
Man, this is right around. Punjabi MC had a moment. After,
yeah, he had a big moment.
A little bit after. Yeah, the music that I was making, it wasn't South Asian influence.
It was just regular rap.
Yeah, it was like boom bap, you know, golden age stuff.
So how did you transition from, all right, so you're a rapper, but then at some point you transitioned to be on the business side? Because you did some stuff with Wiz Khalifa, I saw.
Yeah.
And
Lupe
Fiasco.
Yeah.
So what? How did that come about?
I was always on both sides.
Okay.
And I think that is one reason why I was never as good of an artist as I could have been, is because I was always doing both sides. And, you know, like, the best artists are the ones that are 100% deep in their art. I could never go there because I had to do the business too. But the Wiz story is funny. It's why my handle Ani Hustles, I guess, makes sense. I had a mutual friend, and he was like, "Yo, Wiz Khalifa is trying to come to New York. He needs someone to book a show. Like, do you know anybody?" I was like, "Oh yeah, I got it." I was 20 years old, couldn't get into the club, had no idea what to do, and I was like, "No, I got it. Like, you know, connect me with his manager." Long story long, I organized Wiz's first show in New York City at Webster Hall. And I put my group as the opening act.
So how did you? All right, so we got to break that down.
Yeah, let's break
so
down.
Webster Hall is a
it's big.
Yeah, it's a big venue in New York.
Just got reopened.
So you're 20 years old, and so you somebody that you have a relationship. This is before Wiz Khalifa was big.
This is Flight School Wiz. So this is like
so early days. How do you book something without like knowing?
Yeah.
What to do?
So I had a friend who I went to school with, who was like doing something at Webster. Like, he was working there part time, and I knew that he was in that game, and I was like, "Bro, give me a chance." He was like, "Wizard Khalifa, like, what are you talking about?"
Wizard Khalifa.
You know, like, why? And this dude now owns one of the biggest venues in Brooklyn. Shout out to Rami, like, gave me my first shot. But I was like, "No, I got it. Like, here's his social analytics. This is the type of chatter that's happening on Twitter about him coming to New York. Like, I guarantee that we're gonna be able to do this." And I was like, worst case, I'm going to bring out 150 people for myself.
Just for you.
Right? Yeah. And he was like, all right. I think we ended up bringing out like 200 people. I had a line outside of, you know, joint, just everybody from NYU and that I had been building my community with.
Yeah.
They were like, oh, now we're showing up.
How much did you pay him?
Wiz? I got no NDA, so I can say it. $1,500.
Okay.
That was Wiz's first performance at Webster Hall. And I remember that night, like, we made a little bit of bread, you know, and I was like, oh, nah, this is crazy, you know.
You made a profit?
Barely, yeah. We blew like it on the
thousand,
hotel that
thousand?
Night. Probably less, so probably we blew $500. It yeah, we blew it at the hotel that
night. At least you didn't lose money.
Yeah, but me and my boys had a, you know, like a life-changing moment. And the craziest thing is a couple of weeks after, Wiz's team calls me when I'm in like my 8 a.m. accounting class. And they're like, yo, my phone's ringing. You know, I'm like, I'm already failing this class. And I pick up the phone, and it's Peter Schwartz, who's one of the biggest agents right now, who does everybody.
Yeah.
And Peter Schwartz is calling my phone like, yo, Wiz, I just talked to Wiz. He wants you to come on tour with him. I don't know who you are, but you let me know if you want to make this happen. And I'm like, oh, I might even drop out. Like, let's go.
I'm for the lead.
But we ended up doing like a little, you know, stint with Wiz on the road and like
performing.
Yeah.
Like opening up for him.
Yeah.
Businessman and the artist.
City, you know, and that to me, again, is just like, okay, I think I know how to take a little thing and leverage into something bigger and then flip it. And that's been like a constant, you know, my whole life.
Yeah. I mean, we breezed over that, but the NYU play is dope too. Because a kid from Boston,
yeah,
having to tell your parents, like, listen, I need to go to New York City, but using education as the reason,
yeah,
it changed your life, man.
100%. And I give my parents credit to be able to trust their kid with that, because a lot of South Asian parents, or a lot of parents in general, immigrant parents would be like, nah, you're going to screw it up. You know, and I lived like I was the brokest NYU kid anyone's ever seen. I lived off campus. I had an apartment where you sat down, your knees touched the wall when you were sitting on the toilet. Like, I paid, you know, my way through how much of it I could. Like, you know, my parents were supportive, but like, I didn't go to NYU and trick off, you know, like the rich New York City kid. Like, that wasn't my reality. Like, I scrapped through the whole time. But every day I would show up on campus and I would be like, yo, I got new music out. Or like, yo, check this out. I got a new CD. I got a new t-shirt.
Yeah.
You know, and I built that community. And that really was like the first point, you know, of crystallization of like, yo, this is how you get it popping, you know, when it comes to like building a brand and interfacing across digital, physical, you know, content, culture, and putting all that together.
So you was always like, I guess the end kid, because in high school you had a buzz, in college you had a buzz, but then you fell on some hard times. You had some kidney issues, right?
Yeah.
So 25?
24.
Okay.
So I was born with a kidney condition, but the way I live my life, I was like, if I go out, I'm going to go out the way I want to. Like, yeah. I'm going to go out the way every day I lived, you know, the way I wanted to. And after the Japan Tokyo thing, I came back and my phone, I kid you not, I never told a story. I was on a plane, walking off the plane. Like, mm-hmm. I was still exiting. I had my backpack on, getting home from Tokyo, and my phone rings, and I was like, hello? And it was one of my mentors. He was like, yo, can you go to India next week? Like, I want you to come and score a film with me.
Bollywood
film. And I was like, oh, nah. Like, again, when you were a brown kid growing up, like, yeah. That's validation. You know, like, that's that circle, that loop. So we go over there, and then we come back, and he's like, yo, we got to go again. I was like, cool. I'm just going to make a little routine doctor's appointment, you know, make sure I'm good. We were about to go out for like 6 weeks. And I remember that appointment. My doctor was typical movie thing. He was like coming real slow out of the room, uh-huh. You know, shaking his head. And I was like, oh, nah, what? And it turns out that I had end-stage kidney failure at 24, which means my kidneys had shrunk. Like the function in them had almost been like at zero. And it was like 3 months until they stopped working completely or until I have to go on dialysis, which if you guys know what that is.
Yeah, like, yeah, my uncle had to go on dialysis. Rest in peace.
You know, like, bless him and anybody that's going through it, because that's some difficult thing. You know, as a 24-year-old kid, forget it. Yeah. Anybody is difficult. And he was like, you are about to, you know, go through some real thing. Like, you should stay home and figure your life out. And I was like, but I'm about to go on tour next week. Mm. He was like, no. You know, and I told my parents, I was like, this is where I'm at. And they're like, well, what are you going to do? I was like, I'm going to go on tour. Because if I got 3 months to live, I'm going to do at least a month of that.
Yeah, 24 hours.
YOLO. But just think, where would you go?
That's
what would
where
you do?
I was at, you know. And I think that moment also taught me about fear. You know, as an entrepreneur, fear is like this thing that we always have in the back of our head. But when I made that decision, I was like, oh, I don't think I'm going to be scared of anything else in my life, because I was just mentally, I was stronger than I was physically. You know, like, my mental was just so focused on doing the things that I wanted to do.
So you did go on the tour.
I went on tour. Okay. Scored that Bollywood film, had a crazy experience, came back, and my body was like, nah,
time to sit down.
It's over for you. And I went on, like, this emergency dialysis procedure, ended up fighting for my life for, like, 6 months. Wow. It was bad, you know, like, and I would still be in the studio in the evenings. Like, I go to dialysis in the morning. And still go to the studio in the evening. I had all these, you know, like, wires and things attached to my chest. And, you know, when you're on top of the world at 24, it's an incredible feeling. Mm-hmm. And then when you're at the bottom, you know, that's also a real feeling. And it taught me, like, as quick as you can get it, you can lose it. And building back up from zero was probably the toughest thing that I ever did. But, you know, it, again, just built that resilience to be like, well, you beat... cheated death. Yeah. You know, I figure I could sell CDs. Like, yeah,
you know? Nah, I remember somebody told me that before. Like, once you face death, you really have no fear, because the worst thing that can happen is you die. And then when you realize that that's really the worst thing that can happen, which is inevitable, everything else isn't that bad.
Right.
It's like a lot of things, like, you think, like, if you really think about it, it's like, me trying to walk up to this celebrity to try to pitch my idea, not that bad compared to dying. Like, you know what I'm saying?
That was just on dialysis. Like, right.
And I don't want to glorify it. Like,
no.
You know, like,
no, I mean, but it's just the reality.
Yeah, what my parents went through, what my family went through, like, extremely difficult. And it's, you know, I say, like, my parents gave me life twice because my dad donated his kidney to me.
Right.
And so that moment was also really big for me to know, like, family, you know, family's always been everything, especially as, like, an immigrant kid. But at that moment, I was like, oh.
Does that change the dynamic between you and dad? I mean, I know immigrant family.
Right.
Parent family is everything, but, like, your dad, you guys were close at that time?
Yeah,
is that
close. We got closer.
Got closer,
for
right.
For sure. I think that at that time, not only did we get closer, but it also flipped a switch for me to know, like, everything that I was going to do after that in my life had to be for family. You know, and I had to be a little bit more selfless with what I was doing. And that kind of inspired me to kind of move away from music for a while. That experience, I think, gave me a cheat code. Because now it's like fear. I spent my 25th birthday learning how to walk.
Wow.
You know, like what I, like you said, I'm not scared to pitch somebody.
Yeah, and the thing, a lot of times you take stuff for granted in life. And I think that like humbling experiences and life altering experiences, a lot of times it makes people appreciate, like, you know, the little things.
Yeah.
Because like you said, I mean, just being able to walk.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, we complain about stuff, but then you think about the grand scheme of thing, and it's like Instagram's down for an hour. It's like, it's not that.
I think we're going to be all right.
Not that bad.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to beat life because I can't cheat death. So.
Facts.
Yeah. You did it, man.
Yeah. So, all right. So in the next segment, that tees it up for your journey after that, going into marketing. That's actually something I'm really interested in talking about, marketing, because we haven't spoken about marketing and your life after music. All right. So in this segment, we're going to talk about a few different things, but I want to start it off with marketing, because you have a marketing company, Green Room Creative.
Yes, sir.
So, and, you know, you've done work with Hillary Clinton, HBO,
Juice Press. Yeah, a bunch of people.
So, okay, let's start from the beginning. Marketing, right? Because we hear this term a lot, marketing, and everybody has different ideas with marketing, right? But where do you see the direction of marketing? Like, where do you see your company? And like, because it's all over the place right now.
Right.
So what's your thoughts on it?
I love this question because I feel like we don't spend enough time talking about it. We're just so used to being marketed to that nowadays it's like we don't even deconstruct actually what's going on. So to me, marketing is storytelling. And good storytelling, when you do that, you don't even need to advertise. What's happened is people are using advertising as a way to storytell instead of the other way around. So to me, kind of all of my experiences, even up until this point, with music and with culture and content, all I was doing was telling a really good story, or the best story that I felt like I could. And when we pivoted, so after my surgery, I realized that, you know, music wouldn't allow me to take care of my family, you know, the way I wanted to. And so my brother and I put our heads together and we're like, look, let's get into the agency world. So he had a little bit of agency background on like the search and digital side, and I had a bunch of like background on the creative side. And what we realized was like nobody was effectively storytelling. Everyone was just buying advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a massive difference. So when I think about marketing now, it's about having a point of view and a perspective and then marrying that with really good content to provide value to people's lives so that they learn and get enriched. If you do that, you never have to sell anything to anybody.
You know what? That's crazy because... That sounds so familiar, and it sounds just like Earn Your Leisure's blueprint. And I tell people that all the time, and I'm like, Earn Your Leisure wasn't built on ads or marketing or whatever. It was just to provide content, creative content that was different. And we found our niche telling stories. That's actually how it first started. It was backstories of entrepreneurs and business, and the people championed it. And like you said, that's word of mouth is the best form of marketing. And it's like people double down. It's like, oh, how much money can I spend? And I look at like Mike Bloomberg. You spent $500 million on ads, but it's like, how far is that really going to go? Like, you know what I mean? It's like you have to double down on your content, telling your story, getting people to buy into you. And that is actually a form of marketing. That's like the best form of marketing.
Yeah, that, and you have to have a really... what I call undeniable product. You know, I think the biggest thing that a lot of entrepreneurs face nowadays is everybody wants to get into the selling and the advertising and being like, yo, we out here. Very few people want to focus on creating an undeniable product that could sell itself if it had to, you know? And I think the Mike Bloomberg is a classic example. Like the product wasn't that great. You know, like you could fool some people, but you can't shift, you know, the public altogether, because they're going to go back and be like, this product is not hitting. You know? And so for me, the agency world was a way for us to be like, all right, let's flip the traditional model of like just pumping money into ads. And let's really try to get these brands to talk about what's core to them, and then we'll take that, we'll create content, we'll amplify it.
Yeah.
But it can't just be, you know, all advertising dollars and media buys, because you're going to get stuck.
That's yeah, like you made a mindset shift, like after you know, your health issue, where you said, you know what, I'm good at this, but I'm great at that. Right. And you decided I'm going to go in this route, but still the principles that you use for music are what you use in the marketing, building the audience, creating the content,
mm-hmm.
right? And you talk about segmenting the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Can you get into that a little bit?
For sure. Audience segmentation to me is something that is the easiest way to save money and make money at the same time. And what I mean by that is, like, if you have a message that you're delivering to your audience, but that's the wrong audience, it's mm-hmm. the wrong message for that audience, you're wasting money.
Mm.
You know, versus when you hone in on the right audience with the right message, you could probably spend half and get twice as much results, because it's the product market fit is undeniable. So when I think about, like, segmenting, you know, a lot of brands, they use one voice to speak to everybody, or they did for a long time. Now you see, like, Puma, you know, they're taking the urban voice and the urban weight, and they double down on that segment.
Mm-hmm.
By investing in the influencers and the creators in that world. You know, Adidas was scared to do that for so long, and then they found, you know, Yeezy, and you saw what happened. Nike doesn't really do that. Like, their audience segment is different. You know, they do it in their own way now, but it's like, it's not the same. You know, so each brand and each person's understanding of segment and how you deliver product to that segment is the difference between, you know, having an effective strategy and being completely ineffective.
Yeah, that's actually something that's really interesting, because it's like, you can actually have different marketing strategies, campaigns for different people from the one company. It's mm-hmm. like,
yeah.
like you said, I'm just thinking about that. Like, most of the time it's just one way. Like, if we're gonna go with a marketing campaign, it's like, okay, we're gonna go hip hop and we're gonna have Pusha T do a Adidas commercial.
Yeah.
And it's like, but what if you're not a Pusha T fan? What if you like country music? Like, yeah. what I mean, like, that would probably be more beneficial to be like, okay, we're going to have entertainers endorse our product, but we're going to have this campaign with a country singer, this campaign with an R&B singer, mm-hmm. this campaign with a rapper. It's like three different lanes
yep.
for three different people, as opposed to saying, this is like one size fit all
mm-hmm.
and here. But yeah. you know why I think so many companies are out of touch with culture and just... Yeah. reality
yep.
and they just like, oh, this is what's hot, okay, this is what we're gonna do, like, you know what I'm saying?
That's what they're doing out there.
But I see that on Instagram, because yeah. it's like, even for me, like, you know, I spent so much time on Instagram, like, I kind of like have a good understanding of how these things mm-hmm. work, and I'm like, it surprises me how many companies I see and I'm like, y'all don't even understand, like, this is so corny, but yeah. you're spending so much money doing this, and your titles are all off, your captions are wrong, and it's like, Who's paying?
Who's man's?
Yeah, who's buying it? So it's crazy.
Yeah, and the thing about segmentation is what it allows you to do is test. A lot of marketers forget the importance of testing, because as a brand, especially as an early stage company, which is a lot of the work that we do, you don't necessarily know who is your target audience. Like, you might have an idea, you know, 18 to 30, but that's super broad. You know, metropolitan, urban professionals, that's still really broad.
Yeah.
You know, and what segmentation does is you can run different messages in different segments and then find the best performers and then double down on that and use the insights from that to inform your growth strategy. A lot of marketers feel like, oh, I'm gonna put this big spend into something, it's gonna hit and we're out of here. It rarely works like that.
Yeah.
You know, and being able to efficiently test and turn things on and off, that's a lot of the work that we did, you know, as an agency, and I think that's where we delivered a lot of value to companies that didn't have that knowledge, yeah. you know, already.
I think what you're doing is amazing in the fact that you have a touch on culture mm-hmm. and you're trying to keep it as authentic as possible. A lot of times, and Shadi and I, we always talk about this, like, they're out of touch, out the loop, and then when they try to get a piece of the culture, it's like, it's already changed. Culture's changed already.
Yeah.
How do you guys keep it so authentic?
The thing about culture is you can't fake culture. Unless you from and live the culture, mm-hmm. you can't really talk about it. And the great thing about us is, like, we live what we do every day. You know, like, I'm on that glass building on the 35th floor or whatever, but I'm also at the show, you know, in the front row, like, learning mm-hmm. and watching and observing how people are using TikTok or what they're doing. Like, you got to be on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of brands and a lot of, like, execs are afraid to be on the ground because they've never lived that life. you know. And the funny thing about this culture thing is now we, you know, we've pivoted into telling stories from a cultural aspect for like big brands. That's kind of the focus that we work on now. And I'm telling you, we used to tell all these brands like, yo, this is the type of work you need to do. You need to pivot into more storytelling and less advertising. You need to invest in content. And some people listened, a lot of them didn't.
Ain't nobody listened.
And that's my brother crazy. And I were like, hold on, why don't we just stop wasting our time selling these things to people who are not listening, and let's incubate a company that integrates everything that we've learned up to this point. And that is how the Chai Company started. And so we incubated that within the agency using everything that we had learned about storytelling, content, culture, and really literally brewed that pot up. And now when people are like, well, why should I work with you? I'm like, well, we opened a cafe in Manhattan and had 700 people on opening night. So if you look at a product, a proof of concept, that's it right there.
You know what, though? I'm glad that we're in this day and age now where you don't necessarily need gatekeepers to get your message out. Because I used to play basketball growing up, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember, like, when I was in prep school and, like, my last stages of, like, being recruited, and I was getting overlooked by a lot of schools, but I was killing. Like, I would go to, they would like come to our practice and look for like somebody else, and I would have like 25, 30 points. And it was so frustrating because it's like, how do you not see what I see? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, and as a creative, and a lot of times it's it's like you feel like, yo, I know this is it.
Yep.
And you're trying to convince somebody, and they like, nah, that's not it. And it's like, I could just imagine how frustrating it would be for like, we have Earn Your Leisure, right? And it's like we're trying to pitch it to a label or like a network.
Network, right.
And we're trying to tell them like, yo, this is, people going to like this. Financial literacy with a hip hop twist on it. Mm-hmm. Two black guys talking about finances. And I could see them like, nah, that's, nobody's going to be interested in that. And I'm like, no, I know this is going to work. And they're like, nah. Like, you know what I'm saying? But that's really what happens with these companies. They're so out of touch and they think that they know it all.
Yep.
Record music too. Like
every day.
Yep. It's like you have one person dictating like what the whole world thinks is good.
Yep.
That's hot.
Yep.
Like, no.
It's absurd.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, look, people didn't give Drake a deal.
Yeah. Right.
People didn't give Jay a deal. People didn't give Nip a deal. Like, three of the most iconic artists of our generation.
Speaking of Nip, I wanted to ask a question about marketing because I saw it on your page. Somebody tweeted. Vertical integration.
Yeah.
Because he had that line integrated vertically.
Yep.
So what's your ideas on that? Because people talk about it a lot, but I haven't really heard somebody like fully articulate their opinion on it.
Yeah, I mean, rest in peace, Nip. You know, one of my biggest influences and somebody that just was so fearless and such a radical in what he did, like, inspired me, you know, for the rest of my life. When it comes to vertical integration, this idea of, like, look, building a business and creating something is already so challenging, right? But when you build something properly, the ability to create an ecosystem out of products that are already related to what you're doing, that you don't have to go outside of what you are already producing or where your resources are already allocated to create more products, to be able to create more opportunities to profit and more revenue streams, and they all relate to each other and help actually build each other up. That's the idea of vertical integration. So for him, it was the fact that he owned the Marathon Agency, right, which was creating work in the music space, which was allowing him to get more opportunities as an artist, right? And then also being able to create branding and experiences for places like Destination Crenshaw or the real estate stuff that he was doing.
Vector 90 now.
Right? Vector 90, yeah.
So coming down to Vector 90, and he had basically built a bunch of different businesses that all had a common thread through them, and they were sharing resources.
You saw what was next, that James Harden said they were going to do a sports agency.
Which is...
Which he said he's probably still going to do.
Right, and he should, but... So when I think about vertical integration, it's the ability to maximize your output with the same amount of resources and the same amount of infrastructure that you already have. And your whole ecosystem relates to each other. So an example of this is like when we built the agency, you know, it's two brown guys trying to play in this like super tech kind of like white bro founders world. And I was like, nobody's even giving us a chance a lot of times, you know, like, we didn't even know where to go to. Like, we didn't know who to talk to. Like, it was lonely. And then I realized, like, I'm not the only one going through this. And so what I started doing was hosting a monthly meetup for minority entrepreneurs, and we called it Idea Exchange. And as a way to, like, have people that were going through similar things come and create a forum for like, yo, how do we solve a lot of problems that we're going through as entrepreneurs? So that's vertically integrated with what I'm doing on the agency side, right? Because it's a byproduct of that. I host those sessions at my office. I already know the topics because I'm living it every day.
Yeah.
And my audience are people that eventually actually become clients of the agency because they're like, yo, we love the way you think. And so now I'm using that meetup as a way to build my personal brand, build my agency business, and be able to give back to the community.
How often does an idea exchange happen?
Yeah, so last year we did them every month, and it was, you know, that's a heavy lift.
Yeah.
This year we've pivoted to every other month. We do them. Next one's coming up in April. And, you know, if you follow me or if you know where I'm at, then I talk about them pretty regularly.
Yeah.
We expanded from New York City into Newark, New Jersey, which I feel like is a really dope community of entrepreneurs that aren't getting a platform.
Newark?
Yeah.
I was just in Newark today, actually.
Yeah.
It's a long story.
The Wild West. Well, you were there for maybe some tough reasons. But yeah, vertical integration is just like, how do you create an ecosystem and maximize the output and the revenue streams based off the things that you've already built?
I think Apple is like the best at that.
Yeah. Hands down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're up there.
Yeah.
That goes like into your theory of culture to commerce or profit to purpose. Like,
yeah,
you literally just explained it, and it's like how you stayed authentic to your culture and with the chai restaurant and turned it into something profitable, easy.
Right. And I think the biggest thing about vertical integration too is that it reinforces the authenticity behind what you do. You know, somebody like Nip, all those things that he was touching, music, marketing, real estate, with the he had a the Marathon OG, the Strain.
Oh, yeah.
It was all connected to his brand, the Marathon, his philosophy, and it was all authentic, and the world tapped in. So, you know, he's, I think, one of the most brilliant people to do it and still be him, you know, and coming from where he came from. But that idea of, like, building an ecosystem that's vertically integrated, I think is going to be the future because we're moving away from, like, that high growth, you know, growth at all costs, Uber and Lyft and Harry's and that type of company. We're moving away from that.
It's lateral growth is more efficient right now than vertical growth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So like briefly, like vertical growth is like I said, in my opinion, that's the big corporations that's like, you know, just massively pouring money into things to grow upwards, but you can grow laterally a lot easier.
Yeah.
And through word of mouth and through different avenues that you're licensing things of that nature. So it's like, mm-hmm. even for us, for Earn Your Leisure, it's like we have everything started with the podcast, but now we have an online university.
Yep.
Now we have merch.
Mm-hmm.
Now we do live shows.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have the YouTube. Now we have ad revenue. We have the social media campaigns that we do. And so we can just continue to grow like that. Like Earn Your Leisure, the podcast is the mothership.
Mm-hmm.
But from there, we can spread our wings at a very low cost.
Right.
All of these things that I named are very low cost.
Right.
And it allows us to have multiple streams of income.
Yeah.
I told you, it's like it's one tree with some branches going from it.
Which is, that's the best way to explain it. Yeah. And what you're doing is you're taking market share in each of those worlds little by little. You know, my philosophy at this point, at this age in my life, is like, if you look at all the major companies and the infrastructure, it's all owned by people that look the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's all old white men that own almost everything.
Yeah.
Right? Now, at this point in my life, my job is like, how do I build an ecosystem that captures market share away from them little by little until I'm able to flip it and turn it into something major? Right? So like my cafe, you know, I'm not competing with Starbucks yet, but I'm going to eat into some middle tier coffee spots, you know, in New York City. And I'm going to take that audience, I'm going to flip it, and I'm going to eat into more. And then they're going to throw me an acquisition offer. And I'm going to say, nah, we're going to grow it, right? And I'm going to take the market share away from all these things that exist. And then once we get it and we bring it to minority-owned businesses, you already know. We're going to reinvest
that's
it
like the in AZ, a smart way. AZ's first album. When he's like, nobody noticed us, nobody gave a shit.
But the bigger we get,
the more we take it from other people. That's a fact. So speaking about your cafe,
mm-hmm.
can we talk about that? Because that's heat hot in the streets right now. So what's something going on like that. With that?
Yeah, man.
Man, it's hard for me to talk about my cafe without obviously mentioning my brother and bigging him up.
Your blood brother.
Blood brother.
Yeah. Younger brother.
Younger brother.
Business partner.
Head case, but to death. He's the head chef. You know, he is the he's the lifeblood of that organization. And, you know, again, I support that business the same way I do everything else. I merge the culture and the business together.
Yeah. I think it's dope. So we didn't even say the name, but I'm going to try it. Kolkata.
You got it. Kolkata Chai.
Kolkata Chai. Yeah. Cole, right? Mm-hmm. I went with Pitsio. Mm-hmm. Yep. And the beauty behind it is that it is named after the city in India that your parents grew up in, man. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. when we talk about family meaning anything, everything, it's like, you know, they can go in the city now and see like their birthplace because of you.
Yeah, I mean, to honor your parents and to give a tribute to them.
Yeah.
I felt like that was an appropriate way to do it. Yeah, man. Honestly, like I made a little bit of money in my life. You know, I got a decent car, whatever. That to me will be always my biggest accomplishment. The fact that my parents were healthy and able to see that, you know, at a time in our life where it's a lot of uncertainty, you know, but they could pop up in Manhattan. My mom was just in India, and she was like, thank you for making me a celebrity here. Everybody's asking me about my cafe, and I was like, you've earned that. You
that's fine.
Like, that's that. But, man, with the chai thing, it was, imagine if one of the biggest products consumed globally was just completely being mistold.
Yeah, so what is chai? Can you talk about that?
Yeah,
can you talk about question. That? Because we like to talk cultural nights at Earn Your Leisure.
Let's get it.
We did a bunch on Dominican culture. Shout out to all the Dominicans uptown. But we haven't done Indian night yet. Yeah. So
let's do it. So chai, what is chai? Chai means tea, literally translates to tea. And across South Asia, so Bangladesh, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, parts of the Middle East, chai is basically a mix of spices, of black tea, and milk, all boiled together. And it's like this multi-dimensional flavor profile. So it's a little bit sweet, it's a little bit spicy, it's body, and it's hot. And it cleanses the palate, it kind of like keeps you from getting sick. It's got a lot of ginger, cardamom, cinnamon, and it's like the most democratic drink across South Asia. So you go to any corner, and there's a chai stall, and there's what we call a chai wala. That means like a worker. He's making it. And the teachers is drinking it, the kids, the businessman, the day laborer, the government official, everybody's waiting to get their cup of chai. That's just, it's just a place where all of that, you know, cultural class and this, everything just melts. And it's about the drink. And so in India, when we go back to visit our family, every day in the evening, like there's this concept, it's more in Bengali concept, but it happens across India. It's called Adda, ADDA, and it literally means a time where you stop doing whatever you're doing, you meet up with your family, and you shoot the shit for like an hour and a half. You drink tea, you eat food, and you just talk about politics, sports, whatever's happening, music, this, that, and it happens every day. So growing up, we would see our parents and our family doing all this, our aunties, and I'm like, I don't got work, like, yeah, we're just gonna take this 2 hours to drink tea and talk. And that's how strong family is out there. So we realized that this thing that we have bonded around our whole lives, nobody was telling that story in the U.S., right? And when you think about, you know, talking about EYL, let's broaden our international reach.
Yeah.
South Asians are some of the most economically mobile population in the U.S. And when it comes to, I think, like college educated, they hold like the highest household income for college-educated individuals in the U.S., minority population-wise. You got all this happening, and you have nobody speaking to them. You got no brands that are culturally relevant for South Asians to tap into and be like, I feel heard. I feel seen.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like this is a place that reflects my values. And we looked at chai as being the Trojan horse. That's the food item that can coalesce an entire community. And so we did it in the form of opening a cafe. We're getting into, you know, original programming and content and media, and I got a whole, you know, list of other things that I want to do, but that's the idea. It's like, how do you take something that's so important for our heritage and where we come from, and how do you celebrate it? Because when you go to Starbucks, what you drink is not chai.
Mm.
It's like this syrupy, sweet, you know, like bastardized version of the drink. There's no place that I've seen in America where you can get an authentic cup of chai that feels like it does back home.
There's one place.
Well, now.
Well, I think it's important too, because it's important to embrace who you are.
Facts.
Embrace who you are, because it's like a lot of times people try to run away from who they are, especially in America, and it's like you want to kind of conform
and
fit in, right? Yeah. But there's power in being who you are, because there's always going to be somebody that can relate to you. And I realized this firsthand. It's like, I'm in business. And when I first started in business, I realized, like, I was a little self-conscious because, you know, I have like a heavy New York accent and, you know, grew up listening to hip hop and that's my culture. And 90% of the people were not like that, right? So I'm like feeling a little self-conscious, but now I realize that that's actually helped me.
That's the advantage.
Because there's millions of people who CNBC can't talk to. Wall Street Journal, they have no idea what they're talking about. But when they hear me, they hear Troy speak, it's like, oh, this these guys like from my neighborhood. Like it's like I could be in a barbershop. So it's actually beneficial because they're getting the message from somebody that they can understand. As opposed to me trying to be somebody that I'm not, and then I'm going to miss them, and I'm going to not even be able to relate to the other people because
it goes back to
they know I'm not them.
It's like exactly what you said, right? You can't fake culture. Right, like he's not. He's gonna be exactly who he is, and that's gonna attract people. And some people won't get it, but eventually they, you know, they will because their partners will.
Yeah, I mean, you nailed it. And I went through the same thing as a marketing exec early on. I was trying to conform into like this tech bro or whatever the market. You know, I felt.
I love
like
that
I
you keep saying
be.
Tech bro.
And, and I realized I was like, man, code switching is all fun and games, but that's not me. Like, and embracing culture and who you are, I think that's your competitive advantage. You know, a lot of immigrant kids, a lot of like black and brown kids for us, like growing up, like it wasn't cool to be who we were for so long. Like it was embarrassing. Like my name was said wrong every day on the first day of class for 18 years of my life. You know, like that, it'll get to you. But once you realize that that's actually what a power is and where ultimately where you can create differentiation, then the whole world shifts.
Yeah, absolutely.
Troy never had to deal with
that. Yeah, I got lucky, man. I was a Jamaican kid. Nobody, first of all, nobody even thinks I'm Jamaican, but I'm growing up in New York City. Patrick Ewing was popping.
Right.
Shabba Ranks was popping. Supercat was popping. I'm like, yo, it kind of was cool to be Jamaican. But you know what you said about when you tasted the chai and not realizing that this isn't authentic? That's sometimes how I feel about West Indian food. Like, I go to these, I won't say their names, but I'm like, they're like, oh, that food is so good. I'm like, yo, man, bro,
that's not it.
That's like McDonald's. Like, this isn't it.
Right.
So we I got some visions now for West Indian culture. Yeah. Somebody has to represent.
But I was talking. I was talking about your name, though.
I'm just talking about the culture.
Oh, nobody ever messes up your name. It's Troy.
Oh, nah.
You can't mess up that.
But that was super intentional as well. Like, and that conforming, right? So like, even my grandmother, the names of my uncles and my dad are super American. Like Howard Victor is his name, and even my name, like you can hear it, like Troy Christopher. My brother's Gregory Michael. It's like there's nothing about there's no Donovan in my name.
Was that intentional?
I think it was super intentional on that part.
I think, but you know what? Tupac, speaking of culture, Tupac, rest in peace, the icon, a legend. And I heard an interview of him one time, and he was saying that when he was young, he used to be embarrassed. His name is Tupac Amari Shakur. Mm-hmm. And all his friends is like, you know, John Smith and just regular American names. Right. And he was like, they used to make fun of him. Like, your name is Tupac. What does that mean? And he was saying that, like, over the course of time, he realized, like, it was actually a blessing. Because it was like people, anytime somebody saw him or they spoke, they was like, what's your name? He's like, Tupac. He's like, what does that mean? He had to explain what his name meant. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I'm saying? He was like, even one time he got arrested and the cop arrested him when he was a kid, and he was like, what's your name? And he told him his name, and the cop looked at him like, Tupac Shakur, like, you know, your parents is Black Panthers, like, this isn't what you're supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. Like, and he knew, like, he was raised better than that, like, you know what I mean, just off the strength of his name. So I say that to say everybody's journey is different, and a lot of times what we think are actually hinders is actually our superpowers, and actually, you know, you gotta just embrace who you are.
Yeah. I think in my life, so funny thing is my full name is Aniruddha. That's the name that my grandfather gave me, and I hated that name growing up because it's butchered. I found out that name means with no obstacle.
Mm.
And so when I think about my life, you know, I think I had every reason to stop or to give up or to find an excuse. Oh, nah, look, I'm, you know, we grew up poor. I ain't got it. I was sick. You know, I couldn't get past it. You know, couldn't recover from what I went through. And I think, you know, I had every opportunity to be like, yo, I can't do it. You know, but I look at the way my life went and I look at the power of my name, you know, and I'm like, oh, it all makes sense. You know,
fire.
So yeah, culturally and all of that, I mean, you nailed it. You know, it's like our greatest power comes from, you know,
just who you are. That's it. Yeah. So before we go to the next segment, can we talk a few minutes about India? Because like I said, shout out to all of the Indians all over the world. India is a country that has over 1 billion people. Yeah. But what a lot of people don't realize is that they have communities, Indian descent from Jamaica, mm-hmm. heavy.
I mean,
presence
West
in Jamaica.
West Indies.
Yeah, the whole West Indies, even South America, yep. Yeah. America, Africa, all over.
My uncle was called the Coolie Kid because he was Indian.
So, you said that you actually went out there and so what's the business scene out there? Because obviously it's booming.
Yeah.
More and more people are coming into them. People talk about China a lot, but I think people don't fully understand, like, India is a big economy as well. It's 1 billion people.
It's a big economy. And the greatest thing about the Indian economy is that everyone has access to mobile and cell service and data. Data is cheaper in India than it is anywhere else in the world. Mm. So to get a data plan in India, the cheapest. And what that does is everybody becomes connected, you know, at a scale that no other place in the world can replicate.
Is there a tie between that and having call centers there?
Not necessarily. The call centers, what happened, the reason why that is because India was a British colony. Mm-hmm. And so everybody in India, when you go to school, you learn in English. So everybody in India speaks English.
Mm.
You know, whether that's at the same, you know, accent as American English is a whole different conversation. Mm-hmm. But the reason why call centers popped off in India is because everybody was English educated. And so when it came to onboarding, it was just a whole different.
And they get paid less. And they're highly educated. It's like Nigeria, same thing.
Correct. So the Indian economy and kind of investing. So what's happening is over the last like 5 or 10 years, we've started to see the same kind of startup economy that exists here happen in India. So you have companies like Oyo, O-Y-O. It's like a big hotel chain that actually SoftBank invested in, mm-hmm. Division Fund. Oyo is in deep trouble right now, but that's a multi-billion dollar company that was created by, I think he was like 18 or 19 year old, like a founder in India.
Wow.
You have a company called Flipkart, which was the Amazon of India, that got acquired recently for, I think it was like a couple bill. And they basically just, they figured out what's called last mile delivery, which is like, how do you get to the customer who lives kind of like off the beaten path in an effective time frame? So like you have a lot of the Indian startup ecosystem is starting to resemble what's happening in the West. The problem with India as an outsider is that you have to know somebody or you have to know the ways of the local economy and kind of how things are popping to be able to get involved there. What you don't have to necessarily know is, like, you know, I manage an artist named Anik Khan. He's Bangladeshi. Mm-hmm. And we do a lot of work in India. And we're using content and music as a way to break down those walls and create points of traction and investment. So, like, we don't have to necessarily be in India and talk to labels in India, and I don't have to pitch them that way, but I can have the talent buyers in India be like, oh, this guy's popping, and he represents, you know, this audience, let's fly him out. Now, what that does now is it connects me to a bunch of brands, a bunch of people who have, you know, vested interest in finding an artist that can bridge East and West.
Mm-hmm. Now he's a global superstar.
Correct. So that's the type of work that I'm involved in now. And I think, I don't know how familiar you guys are with, you know, Mass Appeal, the label that Nas. They just did a JV with Universal Music in India.
Okay.
And they've been investing heavily in India. So Nas is executive producing this guy named Divine, who's like one of the biggest superstars.
Oh, yeah, I heard that. I heard that situation.
In India. Yeah. And, and the Mass Appeal guys are really, really heavily invested over there. There was a movie that came out called, what was it called? Gully Boy. A movie came out, it was like the imagine this, yo, the Indian 8 Mile came out last year about a rapper from India. And I remember I was in India on tour with Anik, and we had a day off, and we went and watched it in the theater. And I called my mom. I was like, yo, I just seen Gully Boy. She was like, oh, we did too. And I was like, I was trying to tell y'all about hip-hop music 10 years ago. Y'all almost kicked me out. Like, now y'all watching this movie about a hip-hop. You know, like, it was just,
that's my story, mom.
Come on. Like, it was this full circle moment. So I say all that to say hip-hop is an important cultural export, right? But you're seeing in India a place of a lot of struggle. People are adopting, you know, that story. For people that want to do business in India or kind of figure out how to invest in India, I think the potential lies in solving everyday problems. In India, it's really difficult to do basic things. groceries are difficult. Getting household supplies are difficult because the roads aren't paved, or because you got to go to a market where everyone's going to haggle you, and you got to, like, you know, I got grandparents, I got to go, they can't even go to the market anymore. They got to pay somebody to go. That person picks up the wrong item. You know, like, there's just a lot of friction in daily tasks. So I think that somebody who invents the technology or the type of infrastructure that solves for those problems, they're going to win big.
Yeah, salute to all of our listeners all over Asia. Yeah, we got a big presence all over the world. So India, I'm not sure how many listeners that we have in India.
This is the one.
This puts us over the top.
The real gully boy.
India, come on, let's go.
Yeah, I eat Indian food at least once a week, man.
That's a fact, you do.
Samosas. I love the whole naan bread. My mom is like real, she's real big on the whole Indian vibe, culture. And I told you I went to my first Indian wedding. Shout out to my guy Phuket if you're listening. All right, so in the next segment we're going to talk about real estate and bring it home. Yeah. Let's do it.
Yes, sir.
All right, so in the last segment we're going to talk about something that's always hot for Earn Your Leisure. Yeah. Something that people are always interested in is real estate. So aside from all of the other stuff that we just mentioned, you're a real estate investor as well. But you have a unique thing where I read the way you said you invest in distressed and underperforming properties, right? So what does that mean? What is a distressed underperforming property? Like, how can you tell if a property is distressed or underperforming?
Yeah, great question. So I have an investment thesis, right, that revolves around major centers of employment. If you are within 30 to 60 minutes by public transportation to a major center of employment, then anything around that area becomes extremely valuable for investment, right? So think about New York City. You go 20 minutes on one train, you end up in Jersey City. You go another 10 minutes on that same train, you end up in Newark. Those areas have a massive advantage because you can live at a third of the cost that it takes to live in New York City, mm-hmm. and still have fairly easy access to employment centers, right? Properties in those areas, believe it or not, there's massive distressed properties, meaning there's boarded up multifamilies, there's abandoned homes, there's blocks which are burned down. 10 minutes from a train station, 30 minutes to New York City for a third of the cost. Like, to me, that's just arbitrage, right? Like, there's a massive arbitrage. So when I look at investment zones, I have a thesis which is part proximity to major employment areas, part creative capital and cultural capital and kind of what's happening with artists around that area, and part financial. So just kind of looking at pure price per square foot. But I look at properties that are distressed and not performing that fit within that criteria.
Are we talking single family distress or multifamily or mixed property?
Yeah, I don't believe in single family investing. So I don't know, you know, I'd love to spar with somebody on that, but I don't believe that that's a scalable strategy. I think that when you look at real estate investing, it has to be multi because that's where you scale and achieve, you know, growth. Mm-hmm. And for me, secondary markets are gold mines. Cities like Newark, cities like Philadelphia, cities like Dallas, cities like Oakland. These are all cities that don't get mentioned amongst the tier one, you know, New York and Atlantas, but that have massive ROI because they have proximity, you know, to these centers of employment. And I've built my portfolio around secondary market investing.
Yeah, that's interesting because I was in Orange, New Jersey today, yep. and my car broke down, so I had to get a tow towards Union. Mm-hmm. So we're driving through all these different Irvington and all that, and so the driver we drove through Newark, and he's from Newark, so he was talking about Newark, mm-hmm. and you know, I had a conversation. I'm like, yeah, I heard a lot of real estate development is going on in Newark right now. He was like, yeah, you know, it's getting gentrified a lot of people's coming in from like all different neighborhoods, and he's like, you know, the train runs, but I already knew Newark had a train because Lord of the Slums. I don't know if you saw that episode. That's another good one. And yeah, my guy Fernando, so they do him and Caesar, and they got a lot going on in Patterson. Mm-hmm. So when I asked him about, I'm like, yeah, you know, Patterson, is it like the same gentrification that's going on? He's like, nah, it's slower because we don't have the train like Newark. Like mm-hmm. Newark has a train, mm-hmm. so it's like already on the path to New York City.
Right.
And that's the same thing that I remember Nipsey had said about Crenshaw. Like, Crenshaw has the train mm-hmm. line that they built, or I don't know if it was
building there. Right now.
Yeah, they're building it right now. He's like, once that gets built, Crenshaw is going to be prime real estate because the proximity to like downtown LA, Hollywood, and all that, like, is very close compared to like a Compton or a Carson, where it's further out. South Central was actually prime location. And I remember him saying that, and he was like, that's why we got to start building and taking the neighborhood now, because like in a few years, like, Crenshaw is going to look a lot different.
I spent a lot of time in LA, and if you go to Crenshaw right now, it looks like, you know, massive development everywhere. And Crenshaw itself is not necessarily the first place that developers would think of, but, you know, Nip being from the culture and being from that area, he, you know, he saw it. But yeah, I think for us, like, even in Philadelphia, they're building a Amtrak high speed train between Newark and Philly. And the station in Philly is called 10 North. And that train, that high speed train, I think is like a 45 minute train when it happens. So think about how that changes the entire culture of work and living in New York and Philly. You could live in Philly for 40% less than New York and still commute the same time it takes you to get from Brooklyn to Manhattan. And so we have an entire real estate development in Philadelphia, which is like four blocks from 10 North. And we're anchoring it around a bunch of things, but that being one of them. And I think when it comes to like gentrification, you know, the approach that we take from an equitable investing side is like, how do you involve the community in what you're doing and have them have a say and be able to influence the things that happen before you just go down and start raising buildings and building things up? So we've had community board meetings for all of our developments in Philly so far, and taken advice, you know, from the local people before starting any construction.
Right. So before you even get out to these cities, you're building a team from those cities?
Yeah. So in Newark, so I have two, I run two kind of funds that I'm a part of. So the Sanyal Capital Group is the one that I run kind of in the North, the New York metro area.
Okay.
And that is myself. I have some investors, and I have a, like a GC construction team. And then I have a property management team as well. So originally I was doing a lot of that 360 myself, you know, not necessarily the GCing, but like being on site all the time and like, you know, handling, you know, contractors and all that work, and then property managing, you know, kind of half time while hiring somebody to help me out with, and that burned me out. It's just really tough to do that yourself, especially as you scale. You know, you have three tenants, you know everybody's name, and you know everybody's situation, you know where they're at, they can text you, cool. You got 30 tenants, it's impossible, right? So what I've done is I've built out infrastructure to be able to handle those things and cut into my profit margin a little bit, but be able to give me peace of mind so that I can focus on the important things like the vision and the investor relations and really being able to scale an operation instead of worrying about, you know, the day-to-day rent collection and repairs and maintenance and things like that.
So you got the Northeast corridor that you obviously have the team now. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Dallas, you mentioned Oakland. Are those cities potentially that you're looking at in the future?
So with where I'm at, and I like to be high touch with investing, I think that, you know, a lot of people, when you have capital and you can just deploy it in different places, like, your money's gonna work for you. But if you can build something with your hands, kind of using the things that you're good at, for me, it's marketing and branding and storytelling.
Yeah.
I know I can't be high touch everywhere. You know, it's like Nip with Crenshaw, like that's what he knew and that's what he did. You know, for me, it's like I want to do the things that I know before I get into those different markets. So I invest in like E-REITs, you know, like REITs, and I have exposure across a lot of those secondary markets.
Real Estate Investment Trust.
Very low risk way to get exposure to real estate for people that don't necessarily want to manage a fix and flip or, you know, pick up a hammer themselves. Like, you can research different REITs that have exposure to different geographic regions or different investment theses. And that is kind of how I started like 8 years ago before I put any money in. I was just like playing around with REITs. And then I was like, okay, I'm ready to, you know, build out an actual fund and then go and actually rehab buildings and build a portfolio.
Dope. So you're building units in Philly or developing, or?
So in Philly, what we're doing is we've narrowed down on like a four block radius in North Philly, which is a block from Temple University. And our job there is to kind of revitalize and redevelop the entire area. We want to own all four blocks. Right now we have about six sites, so multifamily buildings, commercial units, and land lots across those, and we're in talks for four more, and we've just been accumulating assets. And the idea is, how do you take what you know on the marketing and branding and storytelling and community angle and go redevelop an entire area in an equitable way and create something that's more than just a place for people to live, that's actually a place that builds community, that creates resources and knowledge sharing for the people that live there, and then that raises the value of your portfolio even more, because you're not just dealing in buildings, you're dealing with human capital, you're dealing with cultural capital. And then in 15 years, you go to a BlackRock or you go to an institutional investor and you say, you guys are not just buying the buildings, you're buying an entire ecosystem, you're buying an entire community. And that multiple is going to be way larger, you know, than if they were to buy a multifamily unit.
Yeah, I mean, you have a portfolio now, but before, when you started, it wasn't like that. Man. You talk about some of the sacrifices, because I did some research, and I'm like, wait, you got to talk about some of these sacrifices you made to get to that first point. I know you have a clip where you talk about you went from 40,000 to 2.1 million.
Yeah.
But people, like, you know, you got to get to 40,000. So you want to talk about some of the sacrifices you had to make?
I love that you brought that up, because that brought me right back to earth. I think sacrifice is that's the quality that separates entrepreneurs. Because there was a point in my life where the philosophy behind real estate for me was, like, we were in a cash-rich business on the agency side, right? Mm-hmm. We're making cash. When you're 28, 29 years old and you see your first, you know, 200,000, there's a lot of ways that can go, you know, especially yeah, when you don't come indeed. From a lot. There's a lot of ways that can go. And I knew that for me, it had to go one way, which was build something generational for my family, because we don't own too much in this country, you know, and for my family, it's just the four of us. So if I want to build something that my parents can live off of and eat off of, I had to make choices, right? So I'm 29. I got a little bit of paper. And I'm like, that Model S, that Tesla, looked serious. I'm like, I'll pull up on my friends in that joint. Nobody going to say a word. And I remember building a package, Tesla.com. I was, you know, pimping out my ride. And I was like, at the same time, I was evaluating this multifamily real estate deal. And I was like, I don't know. Like, it's a $70,000 car. It's a $70,000 down payment. And I decided to click out that browser, you know, put that in the stash, and I went and rehabbed. I went into this rehab project for this multifamily in Jersey City, and I bought that property for $190,000. And it needed $70,000 in repair. But the thing was, it went 6 months over schedule. Mm. So for 6 months, I had to pay the mortgage out of pocket. I had to pay my contractors out of pocket. And I was dating a girl at the time, and she was like, oh, you want to go out and eat? You want to go on vacation? I was like, I don't want to go nowhere. I can't go nowhere because all of my money is being invested into this building that I got to make sure it happens. My pops was like, he invested with me at the time, and then he lost his job. So he was like, yo. And I was like, nah, don't even say it. Like, I got it. I'm going to figure it out. I ain't buying no sneakers. I don't own no Balmain, but I definitely ain't buying, you know, no clothes, no Tesla, no nothing. I just doubled down on, like, bringing that project to life. Bought that project for 190. I put in 70. I was all in at 260. I refinanced out at 350. And so that day, I got a check for 90,000 when I cashed out refi, and I was like, yeah, this makes sense now. Yeah. Like, this is why I did it, you know. And that property now is close to about $500,000, you know, in terms of property value. I actually got to go check on that after this. That's how I spent my Saturday evening. Yeah, sacrifice, you know, if that's the sacrifice in a nutshell, is like, sublimate your urges and your wants for the now to be able to build and grow your wealth for the future. Because, you know, especially as minorities, like, We don't have a lot. We don't come from a lot. Right. But when we have the opportunity to make something happen, you got to be conscious about the decision you make. So
that's powerful.
All money in.
Pleasure. It's been a pleasure, man.
Well worth the wait.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Thank you. How can the people contact you? Any initiatives? Well, you're coming to Earn Your Leisure's live podcast in a few days. But yeah, so what's your information, social media handles, and all that?
Yeah, I mean, my goal is to respond to every DM that I get. I'm like, Yo,
be careful.
No. I've been behind for 6 months. I already know that. You can find me everywhere at Ani Hustles. That's A-N-I-H-U-S-T-L-E-S. Instagram, I'm big on Twitter, I'm super involved in. Medium, I really love like writing articles about the things that I go through. Yeah. So I
wrote a good one. 5 books that changed my life.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm on Medium. But yeah, Ani Hustles across everything. And I urge people to reach out to me. I try to help, you know, however I can, because I know I was once in that position where a question and an answer was the difference between, you know, making a play and not making a play. So, yeah.
I appreciate that. Troy, housekeeping items?
Yeah, shout out to everybody on Patreon.com. That is our Proud to Pay program. Big shout out to my man, Dave. He is joined in at Tier 5. So shout out to him, man. I can't wait. Looking forward to his call. He hit me up. He's like, yo, I didn't get my shout. I'm like, yo, it's coming, man. It's coming. So shout out to you, Dave, for checking in, and everybody that's on Patreon, and everybody that's on supporting the merch on EarnYourLeisure.com, and supporting us on Earn Your Leisure University. That is our online school where we give classes that are just super in-depth on a multitude of topics. So everybody that's tapped in that asset, thank you so much. And, yeah, man, we looking forward to seeing everybody in Philly.
Yeah, Philadelphia. EYLExperience.com. As I said, you got about 2 to 3 days before we come to the town, and it's going to be a really dope experience. And we bringing all of our friends with us, not just the people that's going to be involved, but people that's just coming just to show some support. So, but Ani's on the bill, and he will be tag team with John Henry. That's going to be a crazy combination.
Special, shout out to John. He's the reason that I'm here. So. What's up, John? I see you. I appreciate you.
Yeah. John's moving around all over the place, man.
That's our guy.
Can't keep track of that guy. So book tip of the week, Troy?
You want to give it? Contagious? You want to talk about that?
Why don't we do it together?
Yeah, go ahead, man. So I took it from your 5 books that changed your life, and I saw Contagious by
Jonah Berger.
And the ties to Nipsey Hussle was amazing, because that's where he got the $100 mixtape from. But it was tied to a Philly cheesesteak.
Yeah.
The
circles are crazy.
The place that we're going
is
tied to the book tip. You want to tell them why it changed your life?
Yeah, Contagious to me was, we talked about like how word of mouth is one of the biggest marketing tools, and it just reinforced the fact that if you don't give people a reason to talk about you, they have no incentive to do that. And digging behind what it takes to create a product that's worth talking about, that's the most valuable lesson, you know, a lot of marketers and brand people need to understand. So that book is powerful for me. Obviously, you know, when I got that from Nip. But I went and bought it the next day, and I was like, let me read it. So yeah, that one's powerful.
There you have it. So ladies and gentlemen, Philadelphia, we're on our way. Thank you guys for rocking with us. We'll see you next week. Peace.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Ah, spring. Nothing like the world progressing towards summer to inspire your own progress. That's what life's all about, in your career, relationships, and your finances. Let's talk about that last one. With the Chime Secured Credit Builder Visa Credit Card, it's easy to start building credit with everyday purchases and regular on-time payments with no annual fees or interest. And if your credit score grows, so could your opportunities for lower rates on loans, like for a car or home. Sounds like progress, right? With Chime Secure Credit Card, you can start improving your credit scores right away. Get started today at chime.com/build. That's chime.com/build. Chime. Feels like progress.
The Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card is issued by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Out-of-network ATM withdrawal and OTC advance fees may apply. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.